This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Yesterday, Newsweek magazine backed away from an item in a recent issue reporting evidence that interrogators at Guantanamo Bay desecrated the Koran. American officials say the story is to blame for deadly riots in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere in the Islamic world. The original piece quoted an anonymous source who claimed that investigations into detainee abuse at Guantanamo Bay turned up cases where interrogators put Korans in toilets and, in one situation, flushed a copy of the Holy Islamic Book. The piece was vetted by another unnamed Pentagon source who did not contradict the claim at the time. When the Pakistani media picked up the story, there were mass protests, and in Afghanistan, more than a dozen people reportedly have died in clashes. As the story grew, the Pentagon said the investigation of the claim found that the claim was baseless. And Newsweek's own source apparently stepped back from the original claim, saying he or she could not remember for certain just where they saw the information. So this hour, we will talk more about the case and about the questions it raises about the media's use of anonymous sources and the use of anonymous sources, the use that those sources make of the media. And later, if you really dread those lines at the DMV, just wait until Real ID kicks in. The difficulty of balancing safety and service with states' driver's licenses later in the show. Right now, the business of journalism. Join the conversation. When a news story quotes an anonymous source, do you have questions about where it came from? Should the media be using anonymous sources at all? Can the media do its job without them? Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. We're joined now by Mark Whitaker, the Newsweek editor in charge of this story. He joins us from his office in New York City. Mark, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
Well, news reports say the White House is calling for a retraction. Do you intend to do that?
Well, what we've said in our issue this week at great length is that based on the denials we've received from the Pentagon and the uncertainty of the source that you mentioned, we are no longer certain about what we originally published, which is that evidence of this sort of desecration and disrespect for the Koran had turned up in a specific military investigation run by the Southern Command. And that is what we said in our original story, that we had a U.S. official who said that it had turned up in that investigation. That is what the Pentagon on Friday denied to us. They did not make a blanket denial that no mistreatment of the Koran had never happened, had ever happened by U.S. guards. They came to us with this denial 11 days after the item ran. As we explained in the story, not only did we approach them for comment and actually separately run the entire item by a Pentagon official and asking whether we had gotten anything wrong, but after the fact, after it was in print, nobody at the Pentagon or anywhere else in the administration reached us for 11 days to say there was any problem with it. They finally did a day before our deadline. In that day, we did as much as we could to find out what we might have gotten wrong, and that's what we published in the magazine this week. If we are continuing to look into it, and if after further reporting and review, it's clear that everything that we wrote is clearly wrong, we are prepared to print a retraction.
Well, Mark, I can hear a listener saying, why do all of that investigation now after your article has been in print? Isn't that what you're supposed to do before it's printed?
This was a 10-sentence item. It was not a full-scale Newsweek investigation. The reference to the Koran is roughly 8 words in those 10 sentences. We realized that the item was sensitive enough that we needed to run it by the Pentagon for comment and took the extra measure of showing them the entire item. On the other hand, we could not have anticipated the effect that this would have in the Islamic world. And neither did they. Clearly, the Pentagon official who saw the entire item didn't anticipate it, or presumably he would have asked us to hold the story or not to print it. And even after it appeared in print, nobody in the government saw the potential inflammatory effect.
Well, my, I
the
have
fact
to...
is, and the fact is that numerous other news organizations, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the BBC, and several others, had printed allegations coming directly from detainees about mistreatment of the Quran by U.S. guards before.
Right.
So we try at great length in our magazine this week to explain why our particular report at this particular time may have played a role in this unrest. But it's not the first time that major news organizations have printed the possibility that this might have happened.
But Mark, as an editor, you make a decision about to go with a story or not based on its accuracy, not on its presumed impact. Isn't that right? I mean, you're telling...
Well, no, that is right. And the reason we thought this story at the time was accurate was that it came from a source who was not totally anonymous. Obviously, we have to deal with confidential sources on many stories, but we push as hard as possible to identify them. In this case, we were at least able to identify the source as a U.S. official. It is a source that we had dealt with, that Michael Isikoff, the investigative reporter, had dealt with extensively in the past, who had always given us good information, who we believed to be credible, and who we also believed and knew to be in a position where he might have seen these internal documents.
And when you say we, you mean Michael Isikoff and you, the editor, as editor, know the identity of the source, right?
Yes. So I know the position that the source holds.
Yeah. So take us just briefly through the process. You know, a reporter comes to you with a story. There's an anonymous source. What happens next? And in this case,
in this case, obviously you evaluate. You want to know the who the source is or the position of the source. You also take into account the credibility of the reporter. In this case, Mike Isikoff is a veteran, experienced investigative reporter who has a lot of experience in general doing investigative work and has had a lot of experience specifically reporting on prisoner abuses in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and elsewhere, and has broken a number of significant stories for Newsweek in the last year on this general issue. Then you want to know, once you have the item, what does the Pentagon or the subject that you're writing about have to say about it? So in this case, we approached the Southern Command for comment. They got back to us saying, we cannot comment on an ongoing investigation. And then, because we were concerned and wanted to make extra sure that we weren't getting things wrong, we, John Barry, our Pentagon reporter, sent the entire story to a top official in the Pentagon who he deals with on a regular basis, with the question, is this correct? That Pentagon official got back to us with specific objections to other elements of the story, mm-hmm. which we then corrected or took out based on that feedback, but never mentioned a problem with the Quran detail.
And did you say it took, well, how long, 11 days?
Well, all of this was in real time. This was this was before we printed.
Before, right. But, I mean, by the time when the Defense Department did come back to you, that was 11 days later?
It was 11 days later, after it was in print.
What about, are you satisfied with the process that this story went through, and will it mean revising the process?
Well, that's a very good question, and obviously we are going to have to look into that and take that very seriously. You know, I think there are a couple of issues. One is, how many sources do you need and at what level? And again, you know, although they're, you know, the common sort of wisdom is that you should have two or three sources on every story, the fact is that every major news organization often goes with stories on the basis of one source if they believe the source to be particularly credible. But I think we'll obviously have to review that. We, as is the New York Times and other news organizations, we, I think, are going to, in the future, push as hard as we can to get as much, to be as specific as we can about who our sources are. Sometimes that means that you can't give a name and you can't give a position, but you can give some sense of what kind of job they hold and why they might be in a position to know. On the other hand, there are many, many stories of national importance and public interest that would never come to light if journalists were required to always name every source in a story. You always have to balance as an editor is the desire to be as forthcoming with your readers as possible about who your sources are and whether or not this is information that is important and whether you could possibly get if you insisted on a rule of non-anonymity.
And just to clarify once again, point of conflict in this story, the suggestion of inaccuracy is whether or not this reported desecration, that this desecration was reported in the Defense Department's analysis.
Yes, that is what our item was about. It's why it was, frankly, an item and not a larger story. I think anybody who is now hearing these reports might have assumed that we had done a long and extensive story specifically about abuse of the Quran. And if you go back and look at it, that's not the case at all. As I said, it's about 8 words in a 10-line story.
All right. Thanks very much, Mark Whitaker, editor at Newsweek magazine, joined us from his office in New York City. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, thank you.
Talking today about Newsweek magazine, a story that sparked riots in Afghanistan and the use of anonymous sources. You can call us at 800-989-TALK. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We are talking today about the use of anonymous sources. It is a journalistic practice called into question by the controversy over a recent Newsweek story that sparked riots in Afghanistan and now turns out not to be fully accurate. You are invited to join this discussion. Anonymous sources made Watergate. It broke Dan Rather, and it is a question for all of us in a democracy about how we can get information to the public when it is sensitive and when the lives and the jobs of informants are on the line. Give us a call. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org or send us an email and call us at 800-989-TALK. We're talking about journalism today. Trouble at Newsweek centers on statements from anonymous sources. Brant Houston is with us. He's executive director of Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated and a professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. And he joins us from NPR member station KBIA in Columbia, Missouri. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
From what you know about the Newsweek story, do you think Newsweek did anything wrong?
Well, it's been a tough time dealing with anonymous sources ever since 9/11. The stakes are much higher. And I think probably this is a lesson that you need at least 2 or 3 anonymous sources who don't talk to each other. I think if there's any lesson to be learned, probably Newsweek will come out of this with something like that.
Well, how do we need anonymous sources at all? It's kind of a dangerous proposition, isn't it?
We hate to use them. As journalists, we really hate to use them. But there are times you need to use them because the information is so important or because the people telling you could lose their jobs or in some cases their lives or could come under threats or be injured.
And
there are some things that are that important, but you really have to measure them.
And let's talk about the dangers. On the one hand, anonymous sources could have an axe to grind, and if we don't know who they are, we can't tell whether or not they might have another agenda. That's part
yes.
of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of the problem is that they can be giving information to deliberately discredit a news organization. I mean, that's the other side of that. That's a possibility.
It is a possibility. I think it's more of a possibility these days. simply because of the era in which we're in now. This period of time is a time in which media comes under a great deal of criticism, heightened awareness of national security. You've really got to be careful now as a journalist.
You know, the story of the desecration of the Quran, in a sense, this story has been out there, the use of religion, the desecration of many Islamic symbols and religion. So it's not a new story. It has been out there. And in fact, it's been causing quite a bit of trouble in the Islamic world for American forces. Were you surprised at the reaction to this particular story?
Yeah, and I haven't caught up enough with this, the story and the reaction to understand exactly why this one caused such a stir and such a tragedy. There's no question this information has been out there, reported, disputed, debated. So I think some of the reporting to be done now is exactly how this came about.
How the story came about, or how much of it is accurate?
How much is accurate, and also how this story was in particular seized on.
All right,
and caused such a tragedy.
Do you think media organizations, as a result of this, the Dan Rather story, are becoming more cautious about using anonymous sources?
Well, I think that caution has been going on for a couple of years. I think there's the Washington Post looked at its procedures and policies, I think, about a year ago. The New York Times just came out with a report from its credibility committee. And everyone's doing everything they can to restrict the use of anonymous sources as much as possible. One thing that we teach and that everyone is pushing for now is to get documents after sources have told you something, so you don't have to rely on them, that you can really get a document state of mind. That is, when someone says something, look for the document that either backs them up or contradicts them. In some of these stories, there's no way to do that, but in as often as possible, that's what we're pushing people to do, get them on the record and get the documents.
Well, let's get a perspective from the ground now, a reporter who is trying to get a scoop under tight deadline, and it can be a tricky job trying to decide whether to go with an anonymous source, take the time to find someone on the record, and sometimes that can't be done at all. Jack Nelson is a former Washington Bureau chief and investigative reporter for the L.A. Times and joins us by phone from his home in Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you very much.
As a Washington reporter, you've had to use anonymous sources. What are some of the examples of stories that you've covered that you feel wouldn't have gotten covered any other way?
Well, actually, I've used anonymous sources for more than 50 years as a reporter, both in Mississippi with the Atlanta Constitution later and in my 36 years in Washington. And if you want to know about some of the ones I've used, either I've used or reporters in my bureau have used. I would say that they would involve such things as involved abuses in at least six administrations. And examples, I guess, would be aspects of the Watergate scandal, abuses of power of the FBI and other federal agencies in the Nixon administrations, questions that surrounded President Ford's pardon of Nixon, scandals in the Carter administration involving OMB Director Burt Lance, President Carter's brother Billy Carter is representing Libya, illegal and inappropriate payments and cover-up attempts in the Iran-Contra scandal in the Ronald Reagan administration, President George H.W. Bush's role in the Iran-Contra scandal, other wrongdoing in his administration, lies told by President Clinton in the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I mean, those are just some of the examples.
Fairly long list. Do you feel at any point that you, or had you rejected stories because you knew that one way or another you were being manipulated? Either you were they were trying to discredit you or somebody had another agenda?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it that many times where we've been told things anonymously by people, and if we couldn't otherwise confirm it, we never would run the stories. And sometimes we knew that somebody had an axe to grind, and it was and what they, of course, many times you get article, you get information from people who have access to grind, but the information itself is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it requires you to go the extra step in trying to confirm it if you do know they have an axe to grind. And of course, the best thing to do is to identify the source the best you can, at least say it was someone who oppose the administration if it involves some allegation concerning a particular administration.
Talking about the use of anonymous sources today with my guest, Brant Houston, who's the Executive Director of Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated, Jack Nelson, a former Washington Bureau Chief with the L.A. Times, and your calls at 800-989-TALK. Tom is on the line from Kansas City. Hello, Tom.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Question for us?
I just you know, I was listening to the Newsweek editor, and I don't buy into that. I think that was unconscionable. You know, to come out with an article like that and know what the ramifications could be without thoroughly checking it out is just irresponsible journalism.
All right. Well, let's get a response for that. Thank you, Tom. Brandt, there it is, irresponsible, not thoroughly checked out. We have only one source, and that source won't use his or her name.
I think it does show the peril of having the one source and then getting what we sometimes call the non-denial denial. You're always in danger of hearing what you want to hear, or the person confirming or not confirming something is not giving you the full story. I do think that Mark Whitaker said they did not think that this story would have the ramifications it did, since the information had been out and it was a brief item. Nonetheless, he did say that they're going to review how they go about their business at this point. And again, I think Jack would agree, you feel very edgy if you've only got one absolute positive source on a story. It's better be really, really good.
Well, I certainly agree with that, but I must say I'm a little bit puzzled by the whole Newsweek story, and I agree with something you said earlier about there need to be now go back and do a recapitulation on this whole thing, how it happened and what the exact facts are, because as I read it, and all I know about is what I have read both in the New York Times and in the Washington Post and what Newsweek has said, and as I read it, they have still not said definitely that they were wrong. I mean, they've in one sense said they made an error, but they say they're still investigating. And by the way, the National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley of the White House, also says they're still investigating. There was a lot of information out there concerning this sort of activity before. And so I just don't quite understand why Newsweek came out at this time and said, you know, we apologize for it. To me, it's a puzzle, and I think we need to know more about it.
Well, that is an interesting question, and I'll put it to both of you. There are a lot of stories that reporters do that end up being denied by those who are our stakeholders. We don't retract the story. We don't apologize the story because somebody who the story's about denied it.
Oh, I think that's exactly right, and I'm mystified by why Newsweek did it in this case, I must say.
I think they're a little bit shocked by what happened after the story, especially since they didn't consider it groundbreaking. That may be obscuring some of the thought process here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, though. This is the third time the notion of the impact of the story has come up, and there's a sense that if we had known, what, we would have been more careful? No, is that how we do our job? We don't say, hey, this is a really important story. It has
not
to be really accurate because it's really important, or it's not so important, so it only has to
No, I was simply addressing their reaction to this.
Yeah.
I think you want everything airtight. It's got to be airtight when you base it on sources. I know I admire Jack's long work, and he stayed in business so long because he was so certain, and the stories based on sources were so airtight. And they've got to be, because your credibility is at stake. The source's credibility isn't at stake as much as the media's credibility.
Jack, how do you cultivate a relationship with the source?
Well, you stay in touch with them. You test what they've told you before. If it's a long-time source or a source that you use a lot, you get to really know them, and you find out whether or not they can be trusted or whether or not they may be trying to use you. And when you find that somebody is trying to use you, of course, you don't do much business with them. But I've got to say that you have to continue to use anonymous sources. I mean, obviously, as Steve mentioned earlier, there's been re-examination going on by the New York Times, the L.A. Times, the Washington Post, all the other publications on whether they should use as many anonymous sources as they do. And I do think that in recent years it's sort of gotten out of hand. I think, for one thing, ever since Watergate, a lot of reporters begin to think that if they had anonymous sources, it would make the story sound even more important. And we know, for example, that some reporters have told somebody, I don't need to use your name, just tell me this, and I'll just say you're a government official. Well, I think that's the wrong way to approach it. I think you ought to always use a name to back it up if you can. And I don't think using an anonymous source necessarily strengthens the story. But I think that's what's happened. And I think that over the years, we've just gotten much too loose in using anonymous sources.
We have an email here that asks the question about the relationship between the consolidation of media and the use of anonymous sources. Is there a connection? Let me start with you, Brandt.
I don't really think so. I think I go with what Jack says, that we've just gotten too loose on giving up the right to use a person's name. I would say, if anything, corporations really dislike anonymous sources. That's been my experience.
I agree with that.
We are talking today about the use of anonymous stories. The conversation comes in the wake of Newsweek's not quite retraction, but an apology for a story that appeared in its Periscope section last week that talked about the flushing and the otherwise the desecration of the Quran by guards at Guantanamo Bay. Newsweek reported that that was in a report by the Pentagon into the abuses at Guantanamo Bay. That part of the report appears not to be true. The rest of it is still under question. Talking with my guest, Brant Houston, who is Executive Director of Investigative Reporters and Editors. Jack Nelson is a former L.A. Times Washington Bureau Chief. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stachow, sitting in for Neil Conan. You can give us a call at 989-TALK, as Kathy has done from Athens, Ohio. Hi, Kathy.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. But, you know, I saw such a huge discrepancy between the consequences, say, that the reporters having to do with the Dan Rathers case suffered and the lack of consequences that Judith Miller has suffered for her inaccurate reporting prior to the invasion of Iraq. I know I think there was, supposedly an independent committee appointed to review what happened in the Dan Rathers case, and I'm wondering why there isn't such a committee, like, say, for instance, in regard to Judith Miller, an independent committee for all reporters or all news sources to review, in fact, maybe if a reporter has a pattern of inaccurately reporting and what kind of consequences they do suffer.
Brant?
Well, I think there have been a number of committees out there that have looked at how reporters carry out their mission. I think you're getting the reaction company by company to whether a reporter is accurate or inaccurate. And it's really a question you'd have to ask the New York Times. Certainly, the Dan Rather case in CBS was much more public and received a lot more attention at the moment that came out. But I do think there is constant scrutiny now of how reporters are performing. I think bloggers, both with political agendas and without, are carrying out some of that mission now.
Well, Jack,
but go ahead.
Let me ask you in principle. You've been on the ground. You've been an investigative reporter. Would it help the industry at all if there was some kind of ombudsman, some sort of national organization, an independent organization that took a look at these things as they arise?
Well, I'm not sure whether that would help or not. I wouldn't see anything. I wouldn't have any reason to say we shouldn't have something like that. I'm not sure how much good it would do. But I do say that a lot of this, you know, self-examination is going on already in the news media about the whole situation of using anonymous sources. And I think if you look at what's happened, you've had a number of reporters who've been dismissed from various publications for having either used anonymous sources and then they couldn't tell who they were or who wound up using erroneous information in their articles.
All right.
And there's a difference between getting it wrong and making it up. I think there's, you know,
but overall,
there's some differences there.
Kathy, thank you very much for your call. But overall, the impact on the credibility of the independent press in this country, Brant?
Mm-hmm. What about the
impact? Yeah, I mean, what impact do you think it's having at the moment?
I think the credibility of the press has been under constant attack during the past decade, I think even more so since 9/11. I think each one of these cases has its impact. I think the people who have a conscience and care about this, which are most people in the press, are very concerned, and I think they're trying to address it the best they can. Some of the attacks are unfair.
Yeah, I agree with that, but let's look at this aspect of it, too. This administration, which has not been known to be very friendly to the press, by the way, is now very hypocritically calling for Newsweek to be making some sort of an apology. This is an administration that is talking about Newsweek having caused the death of people overseas and having hurt the reputation of the United States overseas. What administration has caused more deaths recently and hurt the reputation of the United States overseas than this administration? I mean, this is just another attempt, I think, by the Bush administration.
All right. We're going to take a break right here, Jack, and talk more about this when we return and take more of your phone calls. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about the use and abuse of anonymous sources in the media. And you can call us at 800-989-TALK or TOTN at NPR.org for email. Our guests are Brad Houston. He's the executive director of Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. And we're joined now by Dave Marston. Anonymous sources don't always stay that way, which is how we know that Dave Marston is a former U.S. attorney from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, current partner in the law firm of Gibbons Del Deo, and he joins us by phone from his office in Philadelphia. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Frank.
As a U.S. attorney, you use the option of being an unnamed source for stories. Can you give us some examples of stories that you were the anonymous source?
Yes, I can, and I think it's important. Excuse me. To look to the motive of the source. And when I was U.S. attorney, we had a case in which there was a racially motivated firebombing. A family of five Puerto Ricans were killed, and the Philadelphia police got a confession out of a mentally impaired person in the neighborhood, and he was convicted and sent away for life. It turns out he was not the guy that did it. And we came to have that suspicion. The people in the neighborhood knew he was not the guy that did it. And the Philadelphia Inquirer took a very active interest in the case and assigned some very good reporters to cover it. So working with the ATF, we were able to develop a case, but as we developed a case, it was absolutely critical that the press coverage from the Inquirer make the neighbors aware that this case was serious and it was going forward. So I shared some information with reporters, and the reporters shared some information with us.
And why would you go unnamed?
Because there were aspects of it that witnesses would not come forward if they knew the precise status of the case and where it was in the process. But we had to maintain the credibility that this case was a serious case, was going to come to conclusion, and to convince the neighbors in a very tough neighborhood that it was in their interest to come forward and tell the truth. So it was a two-way street. The reporters helped us. We helped them. You know, you don't often have a partnership, and I know the press is very skeptical of any kind of partnership, but on a horrendous case like this, when you have information that can be helpful.
All right. So Jack Nelson, former Washington bureau chief of the L.A. Times, I'm a citizen, and I'm sitting home listening to that, saying, "Hey, that's not a bad use of the press and the judicial system." But you're a reporter, and how did that sound to you?
Well, it sounds great to me. I mean, I can tell you that over the years, I've shared information with law enforcement officials. They've shared information with me on a confidential basis, and I think it's worked to help enforce the law and to help inform the public. I mean, that's what was just cited as a prime example of it. I can tell you that over the years, I've shared information with federal agencies, local state agencies, and they shared information with me, all on a confidential basis.
But is that a question of being used for some other purpose? There is an agenda. There is a deliberate effort on the part of a law enforcement agency to get public opinion to think one way or another.
No, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that it's an attempt by the law enforcement agency to get information that will help them enforce the law, and it's an attempt by the press to get information from law enforcement that will inform the public about the enforcement of the law. So I don't see it as necessarily any attempt to propagandize.
I think Jack's exactly right on that, and I think a lot of people don't realize that really the way crimes get solved hasn't changed all that much since Adam and Eve. Somebody talks. And I think the anonymous source situation is similar to the situation between a police officer and a confidential informant. There has to be trust on both sides. There has to be a record of credible exchange of information. And each side is taking a chance when you do one of these relationships.
That's exactly right.
David Marston, have you ever had your identity disclosed before you wanted it to?
No, I never have. And I've had pro- probably hundreds of occasions when it could have been.
Brant Houston at IRE, what's your take on this? On
well, I think one thing they didn't say, which is there, is that the agenda has to be truth, not an axe to grind, not going after somebody for a political
exactly
agenda.
Right.
And I think when that agenda is the truth is shared, that's when this kind of relationship works. But every journalist is extraordinarily careful in dealing in that situation as law enforcement. These things are built on trust, and they have most of the time they have to be built over time.
Let's take one more
very
call.
Very carefully.
Warren is on the line from Baton Rouge. Hello, Warren.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I just called to say that I think it's absolutely important that reporters have the opportunity to use anonymous sources. But what I think is missing in the press is responsibility. The press hides neatly behind legislation which says that if they did not intend to get it wrong, then they aren't liable, where in fact every other person in every other industry in the country is indeed liable for getting it wrong, and within due course, before publishing a story, the press should hold its responsibility for verifying the story completely, as sacred as a trust to use anonymous sources.
Right.
They should prove their story before they print their story.
Well, let's get the first part of that, and thank you for calling, Warren. Brant, do we get special treatment, and should the press have that kind of treatment?
Well, you'd think we get some special treatment because the fact is, in pursuing the truth, you may not have all of it at that time. But I do think overall the press strives mightily to get the story as exactly right as it can with the information it has at the time.
All right. Well, Brant, I want to thank you very much, Executive Director of Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated, and Jack Nelson, former Washington Bureau Chief at the L.A. Times. David Marston is a partner at the law firm of Gibbons Del Deo. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you, Frank. And just let me add at the end that we did manage to get the innocent man freed and the real killer convicted.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Coming up, will the long lines at the DMV get longer? Stay with us.